Welcome to the Next Brave Thing podcast. My name is Ella Hooper, and I believe that breakthrough is on the other side of bravery. This podcast features brave stories, emotional health, and creativity to inspire you to take your next brave step. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to another episode of the Next Brave Thing podcast. If you've been listening along to the last couple of episodes, you'll be aware that I've started a wholehearted living series. It's a topic that I feel really passionate about. I was saying to my mom just before I recorded, I'm like, I just so believe in this stuff. And I really have used it as such a marker and a guide for how I make decisions, how I think about life, how I show up in relationships. And so I'm excited that you guys are going to go on this journey of almost like, yeah, like hearing language around these guideposts that I read in a book a long time ago, but have really gone on a journey to integrate it into my life. And so I've created a guidepost giveaway, so wholehearted giveaway, where it has some journal prompts for you to start become reflective of where you can start cultivating these things in your life. And I think that reflection is such a powerful tool for integration. We need to reflect and really get honest with ourselves around where we show up in perfectionism or show up improving or striving. And it's not just like you one day arrive and you never struggle with these things. It's just a journey that you cultivate it. And the more you cultivate something, the more that you'll bloom and grow. And so go ahead and sign up for my emails and get that little free journal prompt giveaway. And I really would love to hear your journey with it as well. It's my favorite thing when you guys reach out and just share, your takeaways from the episode. So feel free to do that. Today, we're really exploring guidepost number 2, which is cultivating self-compassion and letting go of perfectionism. And guys, I recorded this podcast and I was like, okay, it's just done. And then after I recorded it, I got all these other ideas for the podcast. So I deleted it and I'm starting again. I have my cup of tea here and I was making my tea and I was chatting to my cousin and she read me this quote and she said, because she's a teacher, and the quote on Pinterest says, "Dear first year teachers, you're not doing it wrong. It's just really that hard. Signed, been there, done that, made it through, and so will you." And this is from a Duane Reed educator. And I love this quote because it kind of speaks to perfectionism. If you've really struggled with perfectionism, life is hard, we can automatically go to maybe I'm wrong and maybe I shouldn't be doing this because it's hard. And we can be under this illusion that if it's good and if I'm doing a good job, then it will be easy. And I have been a first year teacher, so I know how hard it can be. And so even just that using that quote as a word of encouragement to you, that just because life might feel hard right now doesn't mean you're wrong. And so when I think of perfectionism, I think of really like it goes hand in hand with that fixed mindset. And they both are rooted in fear, especially the fear that our worth is tied to our performance. And we are so indoctrinated into that in our culture. So when we start cultivating this guidepost, number 2, we can feel like we're walking, like the crowd is walking one way and we're trying to move through the crowd in the opposite direction. And we can feel so wrong thinking like there could be another way of thinking. And so there's often these traits that go along with perfectionism and that fixed mindset. So the fear of failure being one of them. So perfectionism says mistakes are unacceptable. Failure is a personal flaw. And a fixed mindset says failure means you're not good enough and you can't improve. The other component and trait is it's connected, your identity is connected to the outcome. So perfectionism is, if I don't do it perfectly, I'm not worthy. And a fixed mindset is, I'm not naturally good at this, I never will be. And then another one is the avoidance of a challenge is fear of imperfection leads to procrastination or quitting. And then another trait is strong resistance to feedback. So feedback can feel threatening, not helpful. It challenges the idea that I should already be good at this or I should already know this. And then we can have rigid standards and unrealistic expectations and the belief that our abilities are fixed. And we can really get into black and white thinking. And I think like the biggest kind of controversy that I have probably had on my podcast is people really resisting to the idea of like, no, we should have black and white thinking. But black and white thinking is different to what wisdom is. So black and white thinking is actually a sign that we're triggered. It's when we are so rigid that we can't see that there could be another possible way of coming at a problem. It can get you into tunnel vision. And it's very fixed mindset. Whereas when we're in wisdom, we're more into growth mindset. We're more into being a learner, being in development, being in process. And I noticed, and I was saying to my mum before I recorded this, like perfectionism for me hasn't necessarily been in necessarily creativity or even sometimes in the work that I produce. It's actually been more shown up in relationships, like where I feel like, yeah, I need to handle this relationship perfect to be loved, or I need to handle this, be really good at this, in order to be okay and safe. And it's so people pleasing and perfectionism are like siblings, like they're both rooted in shame. And I know for me, like when I think of like core beliefs that I've had to really work through is that I have to be perfect to be loved, or I have to be perfect to be safe. If I do things perfectly, then I'll be good and then I'll be safe. And that's an impossible thing when we live in such a broken world, and especially inside of relationship where people can have such mixed views of what the right way to handle something is. So you're constantly on a treadmill trying to like perform and please and make everybody happy, and it's just impossible. And so this kind of brings in compassion. And today on the episode, I'm going to be pulling from Kristen Neff's research on self-compassion. And she has a talk around talking about the difference between self-esteem and self-compassion. And I want to talk a little bit today about why we resist compassion so much and why self-compassion is really hard. And, you know, like I think a lot of people can say that they grew up in maybe a compassionate home, and then a lot of people can also say that they grew up in a very critical home. So we've all got a mixed array of like how we've interpreted and received compassion. But I think the big thing that teaches us, and this is something we can learn now, like because this language was not around when our parents were raising us, but something that we can cultivate now is the biggest thing that kids observe is not, it is sometimes like the compassion, obviously the compassion they receive from their parents, but it's actually witnessing how their parents receive compassion. And so we have these things inside of culture, which we're actually a lot more things are caught rather than taught. So if we watch our parents, like they may be compassionate to us, but then if they do something they're really hard on themselves, let's say they knock a cup and it smashes and they're really mad at themselves, that teaches us more about whether we can receive compassion for ourselves than, hey, you smashed the glass and, oh, I'm compassionate towards you, but I'm not compassionate towards ourselves. It's really important, I think, that even from a, yeah, just like as, you know, some of you are parents, as you learn how to And I even notice, like, even with nieces and nephews, like, the way that I treat myself, like, they're observing that just as much as me being kind to them. And so, yeah, I was thinking about self-esteem and self-compassion, but I was watching recently the movie The First Wives Club with my sister. And I freaking love Goldie Hawn and, yeah, Diane Keaton and Bette Midler. And anyway, so it's such a classic. So I'm very familiar with I'm really familiar with that movie. And there's a line where Annie, who's played by Diane Keaton, is walking in the street with her dog and her mum. And she says, yeah, I'm really working on my self-esteem issues with my therapist. And her mother turns to her and says, honey, you have a home, you have a husband, you have a daughter, like, you don't have self-esteem issues. And the line really captures a common misconception that external achievements and relationships automatically equal self-worth. And so that's my segue into talking about self-compassion and self-esteem. So self-compassion offers benefits that self-esteem doesn't. And so what is self-esteem? Well, it's a global evaluation of self-worth, a judgment of, am I a good person or a bad person? And in this is really interesting because for decades, psychologists considered self-esteem a key marker of psychological health. And there's even solid research linking low self-esteem to depression, anxiety, and suicidal ideation. But high self-esteem has its own pitfalls. And the issue isn't whether you have it, it's how you get it. And in Western culture, and particularly in the US, self-esteem is often tied to feeling special or above average. And so being called average can be an insult. And just imagine if someone said to you, you're an average worker or you're an average parent. And so there is this pressure with self-esteem of, like, you have to be above average to be worthy and you have to be special. And so that pressure creates a toxic comparison loop. We then inflate ourselves or diminish others just to feel okay. So we constantly have this measuring stick. And this is actually, and narcissism is a big thing that's talked about on, you know, TikTok therapist. And it's really fueled an epidemic of narcissism, especially, you know, among us younger generations. And so many psychologists trace this to the self-esteem movement in schools where children learn to feel better by feeling better than. And then bullying and prejudice and social comparison often stems from this to boost your self-worth at the expense of someone else. So when success becomes the only part to feeling worthy, failure can then just become devastating. So research shows that the number one domain in which women invest their self-esteem is physical appearance. And the standards are, like, so impossible. So even supermodels feel insecure. So, and then it's crazy because by the time you're, I think the research shows that young girls who are, like, by the time they get to grade 3, that's when they have, like, a perception of how attractive they are. And, like, it begins, their perception of how attractive they are begins to drop. It's like they get aware of that. Whereas for boys, it's actually a lot later. And so how do we get off this performance treadmill? It's such a treadmill of performance. And even as I've taught this topic of self-compassion to my students in America, we put up on the board, like, all the things, like, we derive self-esteem from. Like, we get it from our jobs, like, status in society, how much money we have, the car we drive, and the friendship groups we're a part of. And when we're not fitting into any of those boxes, like, our self-esteem can really take a hit. And that's when enter self-compassion. So Kristen Neff says that self-compassion isn't about judging yourself positively. It's about relating to yourself kindly and embracing your imperfections and your humanity with warmth and care. So she defines self-compassion with three components: self-kindness, treating yourself with care instead of harsh criticism; common humanity, recognizing that imperfection is part of being human; mindfulness, which is being aware of your suffering without over-identifying it, but also becoming more of an observer of what is happening rather than that identity assignment of like, just because I'm feeling, you know, an emotion doesn't mean I am that emotion. So it's an ability to go into that. So self-esteem asks, how am I different from others, like above average or special? And whereas self-compassion actually asks, how am I the same as others? Which actually brings us to connect to common humanity. So the thing about self-esteem culture is it's going to invoke like such self-criticism. And self-criticism activates the brain's threat system, so your fight, flight, or freeze. And self-criticism, it's when you become the attacker and the attacked, which is just like such a vicious internal cycle. So self-compassion, on the other hand, activates the soothing system, releasing oxytocin and dopamine, a hormone that fosters safety, connection, and comfort. In this state, we become more capable of learning, healing, and growing. And again, that's more of that growth mindset than that perfectionist, fixed mindset. So self-esteem will disappear in the face of failure, whereas self-compassion steps in and holds us in those moments. And it says you're worthy of love, not because you succeeded, but because you're human. When I think of the research surrounding what self-esteem is versus what self-compassion is, I'm really highlighted and remembering a concept that I heard by Laura Duncan. And I first heard it from my friends Marcus and Brianna Miller. And it's this concept of like shame high, shame low. And so a shame high is I've hit everything on my list. I've done everything perfectly. Now I can see myself as amazing. And then a shame low is I missed that. I didn't get my to-do list done. I'm the worst. And so often like we can have these highs and lows emotionally because we have like this panel in our life that says we're only good when we're doing good and we're bad when we're doing bad. It's like this, we've never actually won the truth that we are good innately. We are righteous innately. We have to become self-righteous. We have to perform in order to be good. And I was thinking of this example and I had a friend kind of processing like they had this like kind of crazy experience where they got invited to be a part of this fun night where all these famous people were there. And it was such like a high, and then they had such a shame spiral afterwards. And that's a kind of good example of like the shame high, shame low is like, oh, I got invited to be around these famous people. I must be seen the same way as them. So now I'm good. And then the spiral is like, the exposure that sometimes we can have with being seen is we live in this space of, oh my gosh, I'm finally seen. Now I can feel good about myself. But then there's the ugly side of it that goes into introspection of like, no, I'm not that good. I'm unworthy to be in the room around those people. And we kind of spiral. And I think a lot of performers can really relate to this. Anyone in creativity, anyone who has to kind of be in that public space is like, oh, I can feel good about myself when I do a good job. And when I don't, I feel really terrible about myself. And what self-compassion does, it actually helps us kind of stay in a place of contentment. And I would notice this of like, oh, my highs and lows, especially in performing, doing an acting degree or like teaching or being on stage or being in front of people, like I would notice like the highs that come from like, I did a good job. And then like the lows that would come from the vulnerability hangover of doing something brave or getting out there. And so what self-compassion does, it doesn't make judgments of like, you did an awesome job, so now you're awesome. It actually just like believes you're good already. So you come into the situation going like, you're already whole, you're already good. And part of our Christian faith is that we believe that we're already righteousness. We don't have to earn righteousness. We don't have to perform to be loved. We're already loved. And so I love that self-compassion helps us and that self-talk helps us keep in that consistent place of like that steady place. And it's not to say that we can't have like big moments of like, that was so exciting. But I notice like sometimes when we are disconnected from ourselves, those highs can feel like crack. They can feel like a sugar high. There's like a buzzing energy around it. It's hyperactive versus like a joyful, grounded, that was so fun and I can celebrate it. And then you can also have the false humility side of it, which is like you have something really excited happening and someone's like, oh yeah, but my identity is not in that and I don't get excited, which that's false humility. And so we're learning to like cultivate self-compassion of like, I'm already good and that was just like a beautiful moment that I got to experience, or I went through that painful disappointment or I didn't show up that well, but I'm still worthy of love and belonging in this moment. And so even with our to-do lists, we can find ourselves going like, oh, I smashed through my to-do list, like now I'm good, because we get all these feel-good dopamine hits from like accomplishing things. But it's when, and I'm going to be talking later in the guideposts about learning how to untie our sense of self-worth from our productivity. But it's like when, you know, if we go through something in life, like I've had friends walk through sickness and like different things where we can't work. And so compassion is that friend that says you're still worthy of good things and love, even when you aren't producing everything that you wish your ideal version would be, you know, producing right now. I think another thing that we have to explore when talking about the topic of self-compassion is judgment. And I always think of this example when I was hyper fixated around, I had such perfectionism around body image and what I looked like, and constantly felt like never enough. And if I don't look perfect, I won't be loved. Like I really struggled with that. And so it actually made me hypercritical. Like I would be hypercritical of my body, but I noticed I would actually be hypercritical of people around me. So if I saw someone that like maybe, and they were like even really tiny, I would notice like, oh, they're carrying a little bit of belly fat there. Like I would notice, oh, they, you know, have a bit of a double chin. Like I literally would think like that because I had such huge self-criticism around my own body image. But I would like kind of have some denial in this area where I'd be like, no, that's mean to judge other people for the way that they look. But because I had such a strong criticism towards myself, like it just leaks out to how you view other people. And what I realized, like through my judgment of other people, I'm actually holding a judgment stick where I get hit with it. Like when I judge someone else about something, I will have that. I will experience that. And I have had notice, like, sometimes in my judgment, I can have this superiority of like, I would never do that. Like, those people that, you know, have a messy house, I just could never be that way. And when we think like that, we can feel like the worst because we are under that judgment. We have, like, you know, we've kind of created this thing for us that we are now the worst person ever if we fail or do the thing that we've made a huge judgment about. And I've noticed, like, the most emotionally mature people are often the most, like, they're the least judgmental. It's not that they don't have judgments, because it's very human to have judgments, especially in the realm of pain or ignorance. Like, we just so ignorant. We may not, you know, necessarily have pain in an area, but we're just very ignorant. And so we just make some judgments. But I notice, like, the more that I've matured, I have noticed I'm less judgmental. And if I experience judgment, like right now, like if I'm experiencing judgment in an area and I can't show compassion towards someone in that, it's often because I have some fears around it, or I'm afraid that that might happen to me, or, you know. And I think when I'm talking about judgment, I'm not saying, like, that something isn't wrong, like murder's wrong, you know, but there's a difference between, like, me having a visceral response to it based on, like, oh, I'm afraid of that. Like, because I don't believe that it's right doesn't mean I'm, like, condoning it. But I think when we get hyper reactive about different things, it's really exposing sometimes, like, a wound that we've had that needs to be tended to. So learning how to tend to our wounds and bring compassion and validate, like, that's been hurtful. Like, often, you know, those judgments are there to, like, sometimes keep us safe. But then there's also the judgments of, I think that it's so common in our culture, like, you get home from work and you'd be like, this person, you know, showed up late and I had to do their work and they didn't do this and they're the worst because they forgot to manage this part of their job. And we can, like, we vent all the time as humans, like, and we judge, this person dropped the ball and they're late and sometimes it's like we use judgment rather than connecting to the more vulnerable emotions that we experience. Because if I was to say, let's just say, even you're at university and you're doing a group assignment and you're the one carrying the load, and, like, you came home and you're like, this person did nothing. This person showed up and they forgot that they had to bring this assignment and da, da, da. Like, we do that to kind of protect us from the more vulnerable emotions. So the more vulnerable emotion might be like, I'm always put in the position where it's all on my shoulders. And that really sucks. And that's really painful when I feel let down, because actually I've felt let down a lot in my life. And so when we actually process those more vulnerable emotions, we can actually get to a place of compassion of, like, yeah, it does suck that it's all on your shoulders. And you can kind of start to connect with compassion for yourself in that situation and actually be heard in that moment, and then get to a place of solution. Whereas, like, most of us just get stuck in that venting loop of, they did this and they're the worst because they dropped the ball. And like, not to say, like, that is, like, a real thing, like, where we do vent, but I think when we learn to heal, we learn to go for the more vulnerable emotions of, like, why it's affecting us, why it hurts us, rather than staying in that kind of surface level looping of judgment towards people and venting about people. We get to a more connected place where we have compassion. And I think that sometimes we get into venting and judging other people because it's a way that we can discharge our pain in a moment, but it's not a way that we actually heal it and become more productive. And when I talk about productive, like, usually when we even attune to our pain and show compassion to our experience, what that does is release that feel-good chemical, the oxytocin, which gets us into creative thinking about the situation. It actually connects us back to common humanity, which is self-compassion component. And we find solutions and ways forwards. And so I think that cultivating self-compassion is a huge key to being a really good leader, because there's going to be so many things that can frustrate you, but it actually builds a sense of resilience. So sometimes people think that if I adopt self-compassion, I'm going to lose all resilience. I'm going to lose all my work ethic. I'm not going to be productive at all. But really, self-compassion is actually about validation and attunement and connecting to yourself. And when you feel connected to yourself, you grow this resilience and an ability to connect to other people, to ask for what you need, to communicate in a way that's kind and clear. And so it just opens up more possibilities for you. After teaching on self-compassion for the past 8 years, I would notice like different people responding to the topic of self-compassion. I could see some people deadpan looking at me like deer in headlights. What are you even talking? What language are you even talking? And then I would have some people like they'd just be sobbing the whole time and they wouldn't really know why they're crying. And then other people are trying to intellectualize it, trying to argue like why, all the objections around it. Like, are you going to be like a lazy person if you adopt self-compassion? Because we really do think that we'll be motivated more if we have self-criticism, we'll be more aware of our flaws. But what self-compassion does, it actually makes us less defensive, whereas perfectionism will always have to be defending ourselves. Whereas self-compassion actually builds such a big shame resilience that you're able to sit with feedback and you become more growth-minded from that place. But from actually rumbling with this topic of self-compassion with people for many years, it's like the main thing I utilize in my coaching with clients is really giving clients an experience of receiving self-compassion, because I think it's something that we need someone to help us really integrate and receive it. Kristen Neff and Chris Germer, I think his name is, came up with this term called backdraft. Sorry, I'll say that again, backdraft. So it's a term borrowed from firefighting. And in firefighting, backdraft is a violent flare-up that occurs when oxygen suddenly re-enters an enclosed space filled with fire and smoke. So why self-compassion can be this, there can be such a resistance to self-compassion is for people with trauma. So backdraft is what happens when you begin offering yourself unconditional love instead of feeling soothed. Like some of you might be going, oh, that's so nice to hear. But for some of you, it's like the most painful thing to hear because, yeah, instead of feeling soothed by it, you feel quite overwhelmed. And I think that sort of has explained people looking at me deadpanned. Because it's quite overwhelming to take on that we could be kind to ourselves. And so if you're experiencing backdraft, you might experience these things. You might experience grief, shame, sadness, panic, and even louder inner critic. And the reason for this is because offering yourself compassion exposes the parts of you that never received it. And it opens the door to the past of unmet needs and buried emotions. And Kristen Neff and Chris Germer say, when we give ourselves unconditional love, it can expose all the ways we've felt unloved before. And so if you're listening and you're like struggling and you're almost like wanting to switch the podcast off because you're like, this self-kindness sounds like so foreign, like just know that you're not alone and that I think this is why practicing real self-compassion is actually a really courageous task. And so my hope is that learning even just what backdraft is and that psychologists and researchers have a name for it is helpful. And just so you know that you can understand that resistance is part of the healing process and you can realize that self-compassion is working even if it feels hard. And just to approach yourself with some compassion really gently and patiently. And to also, if you're finding this, almost like an unbearable pain coming up, to really seek help to help you integrate it. So I think that it's really important to go gently and slowly with this concept. And in my experience, even just working with clients who have a strong resistance, they'll often come to me like, Ella, I hate the topic of self-compassion, but I know logically it will be good for me. I just have no idea how to get there. It can be the most powerful catalyst in all healing. Just being on your team and being kind towards yourself. So I love it when clients come with that awareness, and it's this interesting thing, you need to go slow with something in order to go fast. So some of you are like, most of us when we're in pain, we're like, please quickly get me out of here. But often the self-compassion process and the integration of it comes from gently and slowly integrating it into our life. And we need people around us to help us do that. And so even I've noticed, because I've been learning to integrate self-compassion for a long time, I'm remembering back to when I first started to integrate it. It almost felt like so wrong integrating it. And now when I make a mistake or I drop the ball on something, I'm way more gentle with myself. And then it's crazy because we get to solution quicker, or we get to repair in relationship quicker, or we build up a tolerance to have feedback and to grow and to show up differently in the world. And so that's why I'm very passionate about this guidepost of learning to let go of perfectionism and embrace self-compassion. And I'd love to hear from you. Were you raised in a self-esteem culture? Maybe it was all about what private school you went to, what college you went to, what crowd you got into. And none of that is bad. I'm not here saying you shouldn't want those things or go for those things, but it's more just knowing that those things can fade away. But what can stand the test of time is really love, an unconditional love that never stops, that never turns off. And learning how to walk hand in hand with self-compassion, of learning to feel good and content even when life is unpredictable sometimes. And so thanks for listening today. Remember to download the free giveaway and sign up to my email list. I am launching a Wholehearted Woman group coaching group, and I'm running a group right now. But if you're interested in being a part of a community that want to explore wholehearted living, sign your interest up for that group coaching, because it's always really impactful doing it with a group. So you can sign up for more of that information. You can always sign up for coaching, but I hope you are all well, and I look forward to hearing how you're learning to integrate these guideposts. Have a wonderful rest of your week.
Thanks for listening today. Please download, share with your friends, and write a review. If you would like to book in a life coaching session with me, go to my website at www.ella-hooper.com or follow me on Instagram at Next Brave Thing Podcast.